Welcome to the Real Estate Espresso Podcast, your morning shot of what's new in the world of real estate investing. I'm your host, Victor Menash. This is the weekend edition where we interview notable people from the world of real estate investing. Today is no exception. We have a great guest all the way from Denver, Colorado. Welcome to the show, Max Hansen.
Hi there, Victor. It's great to be here.
Well, great to have you here. Now, you are a specialist in sheltering from capital gains tax, and I'm excited to have this conversation because we continue to get a lot of questions from investors about what works, what doesn't work. I'm most interested to pick your brain with some of the questions we've received from investors. But before we do, maybe give a little bit of your backstory and how you got to this point in your journey.
Thanks, Victor. I appreciate it very much. I'm an attorney, and I always tell people, don't hold that against me. I've been practicing law since 1976, and I facilitated my first 1031 real estate exchange in 1978, shortly out of law school. I started doing more and more of those types of transactions in the context of general law practice, but I formed my own exchange company in 1991. I had an office in a small town in Montana, Dillon, Montana. I began doing exchanges all over the United States. And then in 1991, I formed my own company, my own exchange company, continued to do that type of specialized practice until 2018, when I sold my exchange business, American Equity Exchange, to a company in Denver, Colorado called Accruent LLC. Accruent was one of my friendly competitors, and that I'd worked hand in hand with their CEO, Brent Abram, for many years. We've been good friends, and so it was a logical move for me. And I've been working with Accruent now as one of their managing directors since July of 2018, so almost 6 years now. And it's been a great opportunity for me. It's been a wonderful opportunity for some of my former employees who came over with me to Accruent. So that's kind of where I've been. I'm basically a ranch kid that was born and raised in Montana and went off to law school, came back to Montana. And now I work in a couple of offices in the Western region with the headquarters in Denver, but Northern Utah and Southwestern Montana, and do exchanges all over the United States.
I love it. So we often get questions from investors about, got an asset sale coming up. Can I invest in your syndication? And obviously that comes down to structure. So if we're doing a syndication where we're effectively selling shares in an LLC, that's not a like-kind exchange. And so we often end up having to say, well, no, that's not exactly going to work unless we put you on title for a portion of the property. How do you typically advise clients who are looking to invest in a syndication if they are dealing with something that they're trying to shelter under Section 1031?
Great question, Victor, or great topic. I run into it very often. You're correct in that when a person sells a real property asset and they want to do a 1031 exchange out of that sale, they need to acquire other qualified real property. That is property that they intend to hold for investment purposes or productive use in a trade or business. Unfortunately, the acquisition of a partnership interest or an LLC interest or shares of stock in an entity does not qualify as real property, even though that entity may own just one asset, which is real property. So what the taxpayer has to do, as you've indicated, is to acquire an interest in the real property owned by that asset. It can either be a tenancy in common interest, or we refer to it as a TIC interest, or it can be a beneficial interest in a Delaware statutory trust, which is another overarching entity that's used to hold real property for a group of co-investors. What the taxpayer then has to do in order to meet the qualified use requirement, that is holding it for a requisite period of time to qualify as a 1031 property or like-kind property, their advisors are going to tell them 2 years, two tax reporting periods. It's more art than science in some instances, but let's just say 2 years. And then what they can do is they can trade that tenancy in common interest or DST interest to the entity, the ownership entity, in return for the membership interest in the entity. And that's basically what's referred to commonly as a 1031-721 exchange. They do the 1031 exchange first, and then they do a 721 conversion into the asset entity. Hope that answers your questions.
It does. Now, if that project is a development project where we might be, let's say, building an apartment building or a storage facility or something like that, now, by virtue of the fact that that individual is on title alongside the deal sponsors, they're no longer treated as a passive investor. They effectively become part of the core ownership group. They're going to be required to sign on any document that affects title, whether it's a mortgage or a mortgage release or anything that affects title. They're going to be required to sign on, probably including even personal guarantees. Is that right?
That's correct. It depends upon the lender. Some lenders, you know, because of the financial stability of the entity that owns the property, that's, you know, that's selling that that interest in the property to the taxpayer, they may forego those requirements of the taxpayer. But you're correct in that in most cases, the lender will require that investor exchanger, you know, to be involved in signing off on a lot of the documentation involved in that transaction, especially the development aspect of it.
Absolutely. What are some of the common traps that you see people falling into when it comes to 1031?
Ooh.
There's so many, I'm sure.
That's what makes my job so interesting and why I've been doing this for over 40 years now, because it seems like every time you think you get it figured out and you've seen just about any scenario possible, another one pops up that you haven't seen and you have to kind of wrap your brain around it. I would say one of the issues that we see is people, like we've been talking about here, you know, wanting to acquire a passive, ultimately a passive investment. They're looking for a long-term hold. And so they're going to end up investing in a 1031/721 type property. And they're looking to hold on to that for the long term because, you know, getting out of that investment at some point in time, they'd have to go through the mirror image of what they did to get into it. They'd have to have the entity divest a portion of that to the taxpayer. The taxpayer holds it for 2 years and then doesn't exchange if they sell their interest. The other thing that we see are kind of a related issue, and that's what you call drop and swap transactions. That's where people acquire real property. They do it with co-investors. And at some point in time, the property is appreciated in value. They get a great offer to sell that property. They decide they want to sell, but they want to go their separate ways. You know, they've aged a little bit. They've got kids. They've got other business interests, and they're not necessarily wanting to be exchanging into another replacement property and then be joined at the hip again with regard to that property. So a lot of times their knee-jerk reaction when they get close to closing on the sale of that property is, well, if we're just going to go ahead and drop it out of the partnership or the LLC that owns the property, and they'll each receive a tenancy in common interest just prior to the sale, and then take their share of the proceeds and exchange into their own separate properties. That's what's called a drop and swap. And the problem with that is kind of related to the 721 conversion I talked about, is that if they only hold that property for a very short period of time, there's a danger that the IRS would look at that and say, you didn't hold that for investment purposes or business use purposes. You acquired that property for purposes of doing a sale and then an exchange, which does not qualify as like-kind under the strict definition in 1031. Another situation we see a lot is second or third homes. The taxpayer, you know, has a second home, perhaps at a resort area, Florida, you know, that they use occasionally during the course of the year. They use it for more than 14 days a year, and they don't have it otherwise rented out, developing some kind of a business use for that property that really doesn't fit into a 1031 transaction because it's personal use property. It doesn't qualify for the sale of a primary personal residence because it's not their primary personal residence. Those types of situations are problematic. Another thing that we see, an issue that pops up a lot, is sometimes taxpayers own what we refer to as mixed-use properties, property that they use as a primary personal residence, but a portion of the property that they're selling, you know, it has a business use associated with it. The key in those types of situations is to try to maximize the benefit of the Section 121 exclusion of gain, you know, on the primary personal residence portion, and then taking the rest of the value through the 1031 exchange and acquiring business use or investment property, and really eliminating, basically putting cash in the taxpayer's pocket, non-taxable cash in their pocket, and then being able to 1031 exchange and defer the tax on the balance of the deal. The other situations that we deal with a lot are situations where taxpayers sell a real property asset. They, you know, for any number of reasons, there's really certain requirements that they have a replacement property, but they really can't find something that fits the bill for them. If it's maybe a business use, it's a commercial property, office type setting, agriculture type properties with improvements on them, special use type of improvements, that they can find the real property at a relatively low value, but they've got a substantial amount of exchange value to put into that property, that we do what are called construction to suit transactions, where we'll use a portion of the exchange funds to acquire the real property and then use the balance of the exchange funds to construct improvements on that property specific to what the taxpayer wants for replacement. Those are the kind of the big ticket items. They're very interesting transactions.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the questions I often get, or what I often understand people overlook, is the notion that when you do a like-kind exchange, and I'm just going to make up an example here for illustrative purposes. So let's say that you sell a property and you've got $200,000 in equity and $500,000 in debt. You have to, if I understand it correctly, you have to replicate that structure, both the equity and the debt, in the replacement property as a minimum. Is that right?
That's correct. In order to obtain 100% tax deferral on the sale and exchange, the taxpayer has to exchange equal or up in value, and that means equal or up in debt and equity. So in your situation where they've sell a property for $700,000, let's just say their basis in that property is $200,000. They've got $500,000 in gain, and the taxable gain on that cap gains is what they're going to be deferring as part of the exchange transaction. But they've got $300,000 of debt payoff. And so the qualified intermediary, which is a company like mine, would end up receiving roughly, let's say, $400,000 in exchange cash. But they've got, I can't remember how much debt we had, but say they had $300,000 in debt payoff, they're going to have to acquire replacement property worth, you know, $700,000. And they're going to either have to come in with their own cash for the purchase to make up the difference between the $400,000 in exchange cash, or they're going to have to go to a lender and get a new loan for the $300,000, or they can also assume existing debt, you know, on that replacement property to offset the what I call the debt payoff boot on the sale of the relinquished property.
So that could be a loan assumption or seller financing in either case.
Yes, sir.
Love it. Well, we're scheduled to do a webinar on the 21st of May. This is going to be open to all of the investors at Y Street Capital, as well as any listeners to the podcast. And we'll be going deep for close to an hour on these topics of what to do in the case of a 1031, if you're contemplating a 1031, and there'll be a lengthy Q&A session at the end where you'll have the opportunity to ask you, Max, questions about 1031. Why don't you give us those details?
Yeah. Like you say, the podcast is going to be on May 21st. We've got that scheduled for 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, 6 o'clock Mountain Daylight Time, which I think you found is kind of an optimum time for people that are busy with work. They have an opportunity to get home or get away from work and unwind, and then tune in for some real interesting topics. You know, like you say, we're going to cover a broad range of things, touch a little bit on some of the things that I talked about here today. But I love, you know, deal specific questions. So any people that tune into that podcast or that webinar will be able to get some real specific information about situations that they've run into and that they're struggling with. It's challenging for me, obviously, because right off the cuff, you know, I'll be trying to respond to some of those questions. It's going to be fun. I like doing that because I know then that I'm touching bases that people are concerned about, and I'm not just giving them a broad brush canned speech or a talk or webinar. So I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope a ton of people tune in and get a chance to learn some new stuff.
Well, love what you're doing. Look forward to the webinar on the 21st. The link to register for the webinar will be in the show notes, so you definitely want to go register for it. And if you can't make it live in person, we will be recording it, so you'll get the replay in your email post the event. And tell us a little bit how to get in touch with your firm.
Oh, yeah, easy. I always tell people the best thing they can get out of a webinar that I do is the phone number. It's 800-237-1031. And they can also contact me, Max H at Accruit, and that's accruit.com. There's also a wealth of information on our website, which is www.accruit.com. There's just a lot of blog posts and stuff there that address a lot of the issues that I talked about here today. But that
Fantastic.
800 number is going to get them through to somebody that will have the answers to their questions and can help them out.
Well, Max, looking forward to the session on the 21st of May. And for the listeners at home, definitely reach out to Max at accruit.com. The links will be in the show notes, as well as the link to register for the webinar. And in the meantime, have an awesome rest of your weekend. Go make some great things happen, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.